Hey folks, Jason here. I do have a call-in show later this week, but today I've got a special treat for you. Just because I'm winding down the podcast doesn't mean I'm bringing you new exciting content. So I have an interview with a game designer. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. I can tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slow down, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. The other Jason.
Welcome back to the Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today, I've got a special guest with me. I have David, the author of the One-Shot RPG system from One-Shot RPG Games, I guess. I don't know. David, how are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me on the show, Jason. So it's One-Shot RPG is the umbrella. It used to be Survive RPG, but OSRPG or One-Shot RPG that's perfect.
Excellent. So I was first introduced to this. There's an actual play podcast I listen to, the Real Play Games podcast. I don't know if you're familiar with DM John.
Yes, the Covenant. I don't know them personally, but I know that they just ran the Covenant of Dagon adventure.
They did indeed, and they've got a follow-on coming up, I believe. I've had DM John on this show before, and I'm a big fan of their podcast. So when I heard that, and I started listening, you know, because they don't go real deep into the system, but they let you know what systems they're using, and you get a little bit of mechanics during their actual play. And I started looking for your game, and I found on DriveThruRPG, downloaded it, read it, and said, I need to get this guy on the show.
Awesome. So what's funny is that I did not start in the system mechanics. When I started doing publishing, I really just wanted to write adventures. And I had this idea for One-Shot RPG. And the main reason why that idea came to me is I thankfully have a gaming group that's been gaming together for about 20 years. So we've had some people come and go, but it's been pretty consistent. But life does get in the way. And so you've got, you know, 4 out of the 5 people show up and you're running a campaign. Well, what do? Well, you can't continue with the campaigns, you end up canceling. So for me, this kind of idea behind One-Shot RPG was, well, I want to do one-shot adventures for the times when people don't show up. And I want them to be so good that the person who didn't show up regrets that they weren't there type thing. So when I first launched, I actually had no system at all. They were just system agnostic. They were just adventures. But the problem is the idea behind a one-shot is that the GM needs to be able to kind of react quickly, prep quickly, right? So the fact that my games didn't have stat blocks, didn't have rules, that was actually a barrier. So that's what led to kind of, okay, I need a system for this. And I need a system that's easy and quick enough that it could be, that basically we can ramp up quickly if we need to.
Excellent. Yeah. And I think you succeeded at that. But before we get talking about the system, let's backtrack a little bit and talk about your kind of origin and your gaming history. And it sounds like maybe I don't know if you're stuck in forever GM, but you get to GM a lot. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I would say I'm not the only GM, but I GM about 80% of the time on my regular group. I do enjoy playing, but my origins, I started probably like everybody else playing Dungeons and Dragons. I evolved from that to playing Palladium games. So Robotech, Rifts, things like that. Call of Cthulhu was called, you know, it's funny, you'll note a lot of my games are horror themed. They're definitely impacted by Lovecraft. Obviously Call of Cthulhu is the gold standard in that RPG space. I never really played much of it over the years, but I had a deep respect for it. I really didn't get into horror until a little bit later on, right? But in terms of so besides just casual play, I got into publishing about a decade ago, and there were two things that kind of drove it. One is one of my big inspirations for gaming is film and TV and novels. I was listening to one of your podcasts. You mentioned about novelizations of film. Mm-hmm. Well, if I think back, I don't do it much nowadays, but if I think back, one of the things I used to do is take movies and turn them into games, right?
Right.
So, and hoping that the players didn't see it or they would see it later and be like, hey, wait a minute. So movie and films have been a pretty big influence when it comes to my gaming history. And so the two things that kind of influenced me actually publishing was, there was a couple of films, and I won't mention them, that I had watched, and I had such high expectations, and I really didn't enjoy, I didn't enjoy the actual execution. So I rewrote them and kind of, you know, in a different universe, I just kind of took the inspiration from it and rewrote it. And that actually became my first publication, which was 55 Below Zero and 6 Feet from Hell, set in Antarctica. No, the movie I didn't like was not The Thing. I love The Thing. That was awesome. And the other was that I had written, D&D 5th edition was coming out. I think it was called D&D Beyond then. And they had, Ian World had a adventure writing contest, basically. So I wrote an adventure called The Mad Manor of Astabar. It's still on. I don't really write much in D&D, but it's on DriveThruRPG. I submitted it and it had over 100,000 downloads. And it got great reviews. And I was like, oh, maybe I can make this move from GMing to publication. So that's how I kind of ended up in that publication space. It's not an easy, I'll tell you, I don't know if you've ever published, but it's not an easy transition because the most important part of the game is missing, and that's the players. Like when you're writing, the players have such a huge role in the direction of the game, the feel of the game. It's tough writing when there's no players there, which is why, you know, playtesting and stuff like that's important. But even playtesting has its limits because, I mean, I have a motto, which is if I run a game with two different groups, I should end up with two different endings or two different kind of paths that I've taken. Whereas when you're writing, you're really, you know, that's one of the challenges. I'll tell you, as a writer, one of the constant things I fight against is not to be perceived as a railroader, right? Because that's the mm-hmm. easiest way to write. Go from A, B, C, A, all the way to Z, right?
Yeah, 100%. You mentioned movies. Not quite a decade ago now. Maybe it was like 2017. I ran a group who none of them have ever seen Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. So I ran a game based on that movie. It worked out great. And then I sent them, said, hey, go watch this movie. And they watch it and loved it. But yeah.
It's kind of precious when you can find a group that hasn't seen anything. One of the ones that comes to mind for me was I actually ran The Usual Suspects without people who hadn't seen it before. And it was, again, it's, you know, obviously great movies make great games. I mean, at the end of the day. Right. So that was, So that is rewarding. And I think one of the philosophies, and I have many of them that I've kind of acquired over the years, but one of the philosophies that I kind of take from film and I put into my games is the concept of momentum. I want the players to always feel like the story is moving forward. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you won't find in my games, like everything is deliberate. You won't find random encounters, as an example. You won't find things like dungeon crawls. I have huge respect for dungeon crawls, but when I'm writing my games, I want things to be moving constantly towards the end versus spending time. And I know that And there's other games that I've experienced where you do spend that time, and that's definitely fun. But for me, this whole idea of one shots, a lot of the times you're limited, you know, you're running at a convention, you're limited to 4 hours. Momentum is just such a huge driver behind my philosophy, I guess. Yeah.
I was reading your Adventure Clowns of Funland last night, and I kind of see there.
That was my... So that was my first, so 55 Below Zero and 6 Feet from Hell was my first publication that had no system. Clowns of Funland was my first adventure under the OSRPG system. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about it too much because I want to run it for
yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't want to ruin it, but it's a pretty neat adventure. And I noticed that you've also with One Shot RPG, since you came up with the system, you've also diversified a little bit with genre. You know, you've got the Way of the Guns. So you've got a Western version of that.
Oh, yeah.
Set. You've got a colonial Gothic, I guess, version with the witches.
Yeah. Yeah. Cyberpunk. I've got medieval. And I'm actually within the next couple of days, I'll be putting out, I'm calling it Pulp Action 1935. So it's kind of that Indiana Jones era, which has always fascinated me. I mean, some people might argue that you should pick a lane and stay in it. The problem is that I honestly can't think of a single genre that I don't enjoy playing, right? And so I have a problem in the sense that, you know, I just want to do so much that I can't. Like if somebody said, well, stick to horror or stick to fantasy, I would have a hard time doing that because I want to write in as many genres as possible.
Sure. So let's talk about One Shot just for a minute, the game system itself, the mechanisms in there. So it's based, it's a D percentile system. It's a pretty simple system. It's built around skills. And it's built to have, or at least in the versions I've read, pretty competent characters, which I like. It's not Call of Cthulhu where you start off with 20% chance of doing something, right?
that's right. And again, it comes back to, I think that originated from the philosophy of movies, right? You're the star of the film. You don't want to necessarily see the star of the film repeatedly fail, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand, Call of Cthulhu, that's, failure is an important part of that game. Being inferior to the power, the cosmic powers is a part of that game. But in mine, I kind of wanted to ensure that players were in the spotlight. So it is I'd say it's a generous system. So one is you have a lot of feats or skills that are pretty good percentages at the beginning. You have action pool, which basically allows you to almost guarantee success. So if you really want to shine on a particular role, the mechanics allow you to kind of tilt the game in your favor during that time. So yeah, you're right. It's definitely, it enables characters to be the stars.
Well, even things like dodging, your PCs get to dodge, but you're now the big bads probably can, but your minor NPCs cannot dodge in the game.
That's right. And again, it comes from movies, right? It's about, how often do you see a no-name henchman? Think about John Wick films, right? I recently ran a John Wick game, and it was a great time. But think about if you were to run a John Wick game, if you were to run into a no-name henchman, the players would be, what's going on if that no-name henchman gave them a lot of trouble, right? Mm-hmm. It should just be kind of one of that. Now I'm. It's funny. I write systems and I write rules. I never hold myself to them. Like in the sense that I'm always willing to change or bend the rules. It's based on the situation. But essentially, no name NPCs and I different. So no name versus named NPCs are treated very differently.
Right.
In the game.
As they should be. I think.
It's like goblins versus dragons, right?
Right, exactly. Or just the big boss versus the minions. And we don't need to. So your rules are out there is pay what you want. So we don't need to go real in depth in them because people can go get them. Hopefully they'll throw you a buck or two.
Yeah.
When they do that, but these are out there. And if nothing else, if you read these things and find that value, you can always go back purchase it again and
that's right,
throw a dollar in. So
yeah, absolutely.
What was the philosophy behind that, the pricing structure, what you've done, just out of curiosity?
Well, this is not my day job. So I kind of am a writer. Would I love to all of a sudden tomorrow be able to just do full-time RPG stuff? Yeah, of course, who wouldn't? But there's really a couple of, so one is that I wasn't doing it for money. I was doing it because I really wanted the creative outlet, right? And again, in writing adventures. Second is because I wasn't doing it for money, I didn't want it to be a barrier. I mean, I grew up relatively poor. Poor. I can remember times where it was pretty tough. And I'm from I'm from Canada, but I'm from a rural part of Canada, a small town, and there's economic challenges. And I guess I just don't want someone's financial situation to be a barrier to enjoying the game. Because for me, when I was young, if I go back to myself as a young teenager, RPGing was kind of what I did because I couldn't afford to go to do other things. So I just don't want it to be a barrier to people. And if they love it and if they have the financial means and they want to contribute, that's awesome. But if not, that's okay too. I always say you can show your appreciation in other ways, like leaving a review as an example.
Right. Excellent. So you mentioned you've got the Pulp System coming out here shortly, your 1930s Indiana Jones kind of game. Yeah. What process do you go through? I mean, obviously you got this core set of rules and it's, you tweak it a little bit for each genre. You can see that like in the Western rules and whatnot.
Yep.
But what playtest process do you go through before you release a product or modificate, a variant?
Yeah. Great question. So historically I've been bad for releasing and then playtesting. So if you look at OSRPG, it's quite a bit different today than it was at the beginning. And there's some new features. But for playtesting, I try to go to conventions. I go, obviously, friends that I know, but friends are biased. So I try to go to conventions. And I'll tell you, lately, one of the things I've been trying to pay attention to is what I call lean in moments at the table. So it's when there's something happens where all the players are lean in and they're immersed or they're invested. And historically, these are things like if you think about D&D, these are things like a natural 20 or a one, right? Mm-hmm. So prior to about a year ago, I have criticals, which are 0-0 and or a one, but in a D100 system, that's pretty rare, right?
Right.
Or it's a lot more rare. So there's a couple of things that I've introduced. One is this kind of bonus success, and you can see that in the rules, but essentially your odds of getting something extra are significantly increased in the latest version of the game. So that's going to, kind of, again, hopefully be a lead-in moment. Mm-hmm. The other mechanic, which I encourage GMs to adopt, regardless of what system they use, is the skull die. I've been using the skull die for 20 years now. It's a very simple mechanic. Anytime something bad could happen by chance, you ask the players to roll the skull die. And it's a die six. And if the one comes up, I actually have a die here with the skull on it. But if the skull comes up, that bad thing happens. Something bad happens. And it's amazing, especially in like horror games or something, it's amazing how much tension the skull die can build, right? And it's always a lean-in moment where people are like, oh, don't get the skull. So I like those types of mechanics that cause players to pay attention, to the game or create that kind of emotional immersion.
Well, and you mentioned another one there, the idea of having the players make the roll. Now, and we're not necessarily talking about player facing, but if you have, there are certain times having the player make the roll instead of you, the game master, it really ramps it up.
Oh yeah. So in my games, the players, so I'll make the rules for NPCs and stuff like that. But so if you say it like, I know that there are some GMs who like to do all the rules. In my game, so players make rules for themselves. I'll tell you a really interesting kind of shift in philosophy that's happening for me. So I played a game. It was a game of Vasson. With a GM who's running it at a con, and he does all, so even the roles that the GM does, there's no screen. All roles are in the open, and I've never done that before. So I was always, I'm going to roll behind the screen, and there's always the temptation that if especially if it's going to be really detrimental to a character, there's always that temptation to fudge in favor of the characters, right? I mean, every GM has done it. But one of the things that does over time, and again, you can start doing it more and more over time. It kind of inches that you're basically kind of trying to maneuver. You're trying to take away the chance and direct the game in the direction that you want it to go as a GM. That's a real kind of pitfall that you can get into. The thing that I really enjoyed about the GM rolling the dice out in the open was that there's nowhere to hide. The die, the roll is the roll. What happens is what happens. And that was refreshing because it added a level of tension because I knew the GM couldn't save me.
Right.
Right. If the role went bad. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a shift I've kind of made, but rolling in the open definitely. And then the other thing is lately, the past couple of years, I've kind of moved away from rerolls as much as I like the way you have it set where you front load the odds in the character's favor.
Maybe
meta currency to be able to front load it. But when those die roll, that roll stands as opposed to, oh, I'll try again. And I think that really helps with keeping the tension levels.
Yeah. High. Yeah. It's funny. Action pool is a bit of all the mechanics, it's the one that I probably get the most negative feedback on. Most of it's positive, but I'll tell you why. So it's a limited resource,
right?
You front end it. And I think this is something that again, that whole kind of, I want to keep the energy and excitement high. So I have been looking at it, but so one of the problems is when I use action pool and I don't need it, instead of the player being excited about the fact that they succeeded, they're disappointed at the fact that they've wasted their action pool. And for some players that bothers them and for others less so, but I've been experimenting with, I'm still using Action Pool for the Pulp Action 1935, but I'm experimenting with some alternatives that don't create that moment of disappointment because I don't want that I don't want energy being drained from the game. I want it to be constantly kind of, again, that goes against my, if energy is drained, it goes against my momentum philosophy, right?
No, that makes sense. Yeah, when I first read the action pool, it reminded me of the old karma rules for TSR's.
Oh, Marvel! Yes.
Yeah.
So in that rule, you could say I'm going to use karma, and if you didn't need it, you only lost 10 points versus whatever you needed. So yeah, so that minimized the disappointment that could result. So yeah, maybe I might consider something like that. I haven't landed anywhere yet, but it's one of the things I'm reviewing.
Right. The other way I've seen it work really well, and it wouldn't, it'd be a huge change to your game. So I'm not necessarily recommending this for your change, but a buddy of mine, Joe Salvador at Raven Guy Games, is working on a sword and sorcery role-playing game, Reaver. Hopefully I'll kickstart later this year, but it's a die chain, kind of like Dungeon Crawl Classics or Savage Worlds with die chain. So when you spend your meta currency, you can increase the die size, but because all the dice still have 1, 2, 3, you know, the low numbers, you can still fail whether you're rolling a D6 or D30, but you can increase the die size instead. Like I say, that wouldn't adapt really well to your game, but it works really well in his.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. Yeah, I like that. I personally like Action Pool. The odds are I don't think I'll ever remove it from the game. If I do come up with an alternative, it'll be you can use as an either or. So you can use Action Pool as it was, or you can use it in this new, new format.
What other tips? Not to steal all your secrets, but
no.
we're talking about keeping the momentum of the game. And keeping the players engaged. What other tips do you have for GMs?
I'll tell you a big one for a big one for one shots is that, so one is I don't like so I don't do pre-generated characters. Mm-hmm. If you're showing up at one of my games, I'm not going to give you a pre-generated character. And the reason, and I guess the reason is I don't like them because I don't have any attachment to this character. And what I also don't like is insert character A, random character A into random adventure B. But that's hard to, but again, how do you do that in the one shot? So one of the, so if you'll note in Clowns of Funland, mm-hmm. Character backgrounds. So most of my games have character backgrounds, which don't really, it's like you are the brother or sister of, mm-hmm. right? They don't really change, they don't impact your creativity as to who you're going to, the character you're going to create. But it gives you a hook. And I'll tell you the difference between a game where it's just random characters in a random adventure versus one where you've handed out these background hooks is like night and day. I mean, it creates, again, going hand in hand with momentum is immersion, right? I really try to do as much as I can to bring, to create some type of strong, not just a, you know, some type of emotional connection between the game and the player. So background hooks, especially for one shots, are invaluable in my opinion, even in campaigns. I mean, I'm sure everybody does this on campaigns, but I mean, on my regular group, I would do campaigns more often than not. But I, you know, when you're planning for the next week, you have your what's happening in terms of the overall story, but then you have what's happening with each character, right? What are the subplots? What are their story arcs? And so that all leads to greater, greater immersion. In the game. Yeah. So that'd be a big one. Go ahead.
No, you're good. I was just going to say, one thing I really liked with Clowns of Funland is each player would come up with their own background and your background hooks go on top of that. So stop them from coming up with a character they want to play.
No, I want to kind of dilute the creativity of the player, right? Like when you show up at a, so here's how I set up at a convention. So because I look at these as movies, when you show up at my table, I probably have 50 pictures of various celebrities, right? Mm-hmm. And then I have the character sheets, you grab your celebrity and picking a celebrity. So some people have asked me, well, why are you doing that? And again, the philosophy is I need to get a player very quickly from what game are we playing to, okay, I have a character and I'm in this. And by picking a celebrity, it immediately kind of fills in the blanks as to what type of character I'm going to play, right? It's kind of a jump start. So they get that, they tape it to the character sheet, they fill out their rules, and they get their background hook, and they're in. Funny story, I learned the hard way that when I pick celebrities, they can't be random. I need to be very deliberate in terms of what celebrities should be in this adventure or film. And it happened in the very first one of the early play tests of Clowns of Funland. One of the celebrities that was put out was Samuel L. Jackson, and someone selected them. That adventure did not go. Specifically because of that adventure did not go in the direction that I thought, right? Because right. Samuel Jackson is not going to be scared of clowns, right?
No. What was it? Too many clowns on his plane that evolved into the plane?
Exactly what it evolved into. Yeah. So you know, anything that you can do to jumpstart the players, get their imagination going, inspire them, get them immersed in the game. Anything that you do on that front is worth doing. You're going to have a much better experience.
Yeah. I haven't looked through all your adventures, but you know, just because I read it last night, we're talking about clowns. You know, there's a ton of handouts in there as well, and pictures and things to show the players to help them to help with that immersion and joint imagination, right?
I believe you use a lot of photos, right?
Or
a lot
I do. Of images. No, I do. I'll do slideshows with pictures and just in the background, you know, as we go. Yeah.
So that's another huge one. There will not be a NPC setting. Like I would have a picture for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Everything in the game. And so it's funny, I don't use my regular game is virtual, so we're on Roll20. But I would never use maps, tokens, fog of war. Like, I don't do that. I don't do that stuff. Like, if there's an encounter, if the setting is important, I might have a picture of the environment. Mm-hmm. And then there's pictures of the people, the villains, the NPCs, what have you. Right. And that's basically it. I will occasionally use a map, but it, you know, if it's like, like we're not moving tokens around on the board. I understand the utility of that. I understand that that's, you know, I've played in games where that's been used. I've played in games with miniatures, and that adds another layer to it. And it's really, mm-hmm. and it can be really fun. It's just my style is, you know, it's, I guess I want to use a picture to inspire you, but outside of that, the encounter is kind of theater of the mind type.
Right. No, I agree with that. And I enjoy both type of games as well. I'm in a Pathfinder 1 game with some friends. And in that one, we use tokens and maps. And that game system is built to be a, you know, board game effectively when you're doing combat, where I'm also running, you know, Palladium's After the Bomb setting.
Oh, okay. You're a Palladium player. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'm running the old Roadhogs adventure for some groups. And we, you know, when we started off with they were in a little roadside diner, and some of the gang came in to rob the diner. And so they got to break up the fight in the beginning, and that was all theater of the mind, but it worked great because the players just going, oh, is there a light on there? Can I jump up and swing? Yeah, of course you can. And you know, where if you preset the map, you can limit their creativity to something.
Yeah, that's a great point. I never thought of that before. That is actually a great point. You're right. Because oftentimes it is, again, I find it's coming from the player, not necessarily from me, right? Yeah, that's great that you're playing a Palladium game. That's a company that I, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing a resurgence, right? Like, I don't know if they're published. Have they been publishing? Oh, okay. Yeah.
They're still out there. They just did a very successful Kickstarter Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They got the rights. To come back. Yeah. They're doing new art for it. And yeah, but they're still putting things out. They put out a new Beyond the Supernatural source book not too long ago.
Have they? That's awesome.
They're still out there. Yeah,
I think that book, I think Beyond the Supernatural is within reach somewhere.
that first edition, we talked about art, that cover is so great.
Oh, yeah. So impactful. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
absolutely wonderful. Yeah. That was great. In fact, it was Beyond the Supernatural that the reason why Call of Cthulhu didn't get more of a presence at our table was because of Beyond the Supernatural.
Yeah. Great game.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed those games. I like you, you know, started Dungeons and Dragons, and then we moved on to Middle Earth role playing and Rollmaster.
I have a bunch of MERP. I still have them upstairs.
Yeah, they're great. Is it exactly you know Tolkien? You can argue, but the art and the writing in those books, it's like the West End game Star Wars. You know, it's just such a great.
For sure. Oh, yeah. And the maps, the MERP maps were amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. All that stuff. Wonderful.
Yeah.
But we're getting a little off topic, but.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's my fault, but it's No, we're good. The other thing I found with virtual tabletops and Roll20, and it depends on the group. If you're in the same group all the time, it's not as big a deal. But I'll find that some players also get distracted. Well, I need to build this macro or fiddle with this on my character sheet. And they'll do that during the game. And then they're distracted during the game because they're fiddling with.
You're right. Tokens. Yeah. And I mean, distractions are always who knows what people are doing in another browser during a virtual game. I mean, it's just kind of one of the things you have to accept. But if you have a game that has immersion and momentum, they're going to minimize that, right? If they're invested, I guess to some extent, I look to myself as, I need to, if I notice one of my players is not paying attention, well, it's up to me to kind of re-engage with them, right? Yeah, it's funny, the macros stuff, I don't use the roll 20 die roller. I still like to roll real dice myself. So I have my dice tray here and my thing of dice and I don't know, it's just not the same. I mean, I understand the benefit of being able to click on a button and have it do all your calculations for you. But nothing substitutes rolling real dice in my opinion. So I encourage most of my players do roll real dice. Some of them do, Some of them do the roll 20, but for me, it's real dice all the way.
No, that's how my games are. That after the bomb game, we actually just do a Zoom call and play, and everybody's rolling real dice. And in most of the games, we do that. The Pathfinder game, we use the roller, but because of the math in that game, to some degree, the way you can do critical hits and like there are different damage rolls, it does it all. It does speed the game. There's no question because it does it all once.
Yeah.
But
you're right, because it'll be I've played some D&D 5e games, and D&D Beyond is definitely, it's better to have my character sheet in there than it is not to, because it's just easier. Yeah.
Right. I much prefer real dice, and people have, we all, if we're gamers, we have tons of dice. It's just natural to buy all these dice and you want to use them.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Every time I go into a game store, I'm like, oh, that's a new set of dice I don't have. I need to pick that up.
Right. Though we have that one set that we almost always use, probably.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And my favorite dice. So, it's funny. It's funny. But I just keep it whatever you want to do. That's if you want to use a die roller, that's fine. You want to use dice, that's fine. But just know that I'll be using the real dice. Yeah.
Yeah. So conventions. You mentioned doing conventions. Do you ever get down here to the States, or people have to get up there?
I've been thinking about it. So most of the conventions have been local to Canada. I was thinking about the Necronomicon 2024 is in Providence. I was thinking about heading down to that. But I guess I have my radar up on conventions now, because they are a great way. For one, it's a primary way that I playtest. You meet you always meet amazing people, and it's you get great feedback. I'd be open to, like, if you have any suggestions, I'd be open to.
The one I would think of would be ShireCon, which is in Connecticut. It's in Connecticut in, I want to say August. No, so I don't remember what month. It's August, September. I might be wrong on that. I'll send you a link to it. But it's a fairly small convention still. But it's
okay. That's awesome. I love those. Those are great.
It's gathering momentum and getting more attention. There's more people.
That's cool. Do you head over to that one?
I was going to this year, and they ended up changing venues and pushing it back. And unfortunately, with my job, we kind of schedule our vacation time at the beginning of the year, because 24/7 operation. It just didn't work out for me this year.
Yeah. Okay.
I do hope to get down there next year. I know some people that are going, like Daniel Norton from Bandits Keeps going up there, and some other folks are going to it. I know. I know Joe Salvador of Raven Guy Games might be going to Necronomicon. He was talking about.
Oh, okay. I've never been, but I've heard great reviews. Anyone who's gone has said it was great. So and it'd be awesome to run like the Covenant of Dagon in Lovecraft Country, right?
Right. Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what kind of, and this might be one of those loaded questions, what kind of research do you tend to do when you're writing an adventure? Do you, if you're doing something like that, obviously with Lovecraft, it's pretty easy because there's a ton of stuff.
It depends on the adventure, right? So for example, I have one, I have an adventure in War of the Roses, which is historical. It's not horror. It's actually historical, right? That's kind of the genre. So for that one, the amount of research that I would have done would have been fairly extensive. I mean, it's mostly listening to documentaries, listening to podcasts, reading Wikipedia, those type things. Others, like, if I think about Massacre at Tortoise Lake, that's a camp slasher, right? I mean, I'm not doing a whole lot of research on that one, other than thinking about maybe watching some movies in that genre to get some, get some tips or something like that. Right.
Right.
So I'll tell you a tool that has become fairly useful, and I understand the controversy around it, but ChatGPT is pretty good for pulling together. So not for writing, but for what information do you got on quantum mechanics, or is it, like, if it's something that's it's a shortcut to having to do a lot of Google searches, I find,
right,
to give you some quick information, or at least point you in the direction where you can then go and do your searches on your own. Yeah,
sure. And I guess that would lead to another potentially controversial thing. And you know, I told you no gotcha questions. But yeah, like for art, you know, art's always a question, and especially like with yours, where you're not bringing in lots of money to or running Kickstarters to pay a lot of money for art.
So my art comes, as you'll note, I don't have a lot of art, as in someone has mm-hmm. drawn it. And I love art. I mean, obviously, and there's amazing artists out there. So to some extent, there is a cost limitation when you're a small publisher that art is, you know, cost money, and it should cost money because, mm-hmm. you know, it takes a lot of effort and work. But that's not but the cost isn't really why I went in the direction that I went in. The main reason is that for as long as, I guess if I go back probably a couple of decades, when we really adopted this, like I really adopted this movie and TV shows influencing it, mm-hmm. almost all of the time I'm using photo in my own games, I'm using images that I get from movies or TV shows.
Right.
And that kind of went over into my games, right? So most of, if you look in my games, that what that primarily is stock art. So I'll buy stock art off of various websites, and then I take it into Photoshop and change it, mm-hmm. right? I'll cut, you know, I'll basically change it so that it fits my game, or I alter it so it fits my game. So that's primarily where art comes from. So the controversially, you're probably, you know, is Midjourney and things like that. Yeah. So those AI things. So I think that they are going to, I think there's all kinds of legal stuff that needs to be figured out, right? And until that's figured out, you know, there's a big question mark over it, but they are going to have a role. And I'll tell you, there's one GM, and I'm thinking about 5 or 10 years down the road. There's a GM that I know who, if an NPC, his games are dynamic. If an NPC comes up, he likes to use pictures. He's creating that NPC mm-hmm. image on the fly and dropping it into the game. Yes, all of where that picture is coming from all needs to, the ethics of that all need to be sorted out. But the fact that it can do that is pretty, you know, that's pretty amazing in terms of the capability. I'm not saying that it should ever replace art or anything like that, but for a situation where, oh, I'm running a personal game and I need a random picture and it's coming from a reputable kind of engine. Sure, why not? Right. I mean, that's, I like a lot of people it's not just artists where AI can become is a big question mark, right? I mean, I'm sure AI can write. I'm sure the AI in 5 years now, they're going to be able to write better adventures than I can. I don't know. It has the whole, you talk about research, it'll mm-hmm. have the whole knowledge of humanity at its disposal. I don't have that.
Right. Well, there's already the writing controversy with like Sports Illustrated and with magazines.
That's right. Yeah.
And things like that. Yeah. So it's.
Yeah. It's funny. So it came down to, and I really debated it because, of course, I've spent the weekend using Midjourney and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But it's funny. I asked myself a very simple question. Which was, and I flipped it around a bit. I said, would I want all of my players to be AI? Because AI is going to be, they're never going to forget the rules. They're always going to pay attention. They're going to cater their playing style to what I like as the GM. They're probably going to be very engaging. But if somebody told me, hey, tomorrow you can play with 4 AI players. There's something doesn't sit right. Right. You're just kind of like, that's just, it's fake. It's not genuine. And, mm-hmm. and whereas I think the best RPG experiences with people are genuine ones. And that's kind of where I land. So who knows where everything's going to shake out, but for me, that connection with people, just like we're doing today. I mean, you could be an AI interviewer, right? But we're not going to get the same. We're not going to, you know, in the future you could be, but we're not going to get that same connection.
Right. 100%. Yeah. And we will see. It's, you know, AI is not going away. It's getting everywhere, from business to public safety to you name it. It's out there. So it's one of those things. But I appreciate your fielding the question. That was kind of it wasn't a gotcha question, but it was, we hadn't talked about it before the interview. So
yeah, no, for sure.
So what have I borrow this from Kevin over the Red Caps podcast. Definitely want to give him credit for this question, but what question have I not asked you that I should, when you talk to, you know, interviewers or somebody, what question do you wish they asked, wish they would ask you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I think you've been pretty comprehensive in your questions, so I don't feel like I've missed anything. But I think when I think about role playing in general, for me, it's funny because think about Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro and some of the controversies that have been surrounding them over the last couple of years. And the reason is that they're businesses. Like, at the end of the day, they're businesses. And while I think there's a role for businesses, I think that the heart of RPGs comes from, like if I made no money, I would still write them. I would still play them, right? So I think that kind of, I guess when I run into other players or people like yourself or GMs, the thing that kind of keeps me going or gives me inspiration is that passion that I see for RPGs. It's funny, you've mentioned Kickstarter a couple of times. You've mentioned games that I haven't heard of. And it's really cool how much is going on in the RPG space that's not Wizards of the Coast, right? And again, not to knock them, they have a great product, but the thing that I find that's cool today, I mean, if you think about back when Palladium was, I mean, really it was, we got D&D, what are we playing today? D&D, Palladium, and, you know, I mean, you had like six games you could pick from. Now there's hundreds. And I don't see, it's funny, some people might go, well, isn't that competition? I don't see that. I want you to play my game because it inspired you to play it, and then I want you to play someone else's game tomorrow because it inspired you to play it, and I want to play their game tomorrow because it inspired me to play it. And so for me, inspiration and finding sources of inspiration is a big driver. And again, going back to what I mentioned earlier, like I don't write, like, the genuineness is important. Like, I don't write, you won't find any games that I write that I did because I did some calculation and said, oh, well, this is going to get me, this is what 60% of the players want. Like, I'm not doing a behind the scenes formula to figure out what's going to sell. Otherwise, if I did that, I'd just be writing D&D adventures.
Well, that's the sad truth. There's still the big dog on the block. And if you wanted to make money making it 5e compatibles, the smart thing to do marketing wise.
Listen, and I know we're running out of time, but I'll tell you one of the great things about one shots and why I love them. And because I feel like there's a lot of, I feel like today there's a lot of players who are in the D&D lane. And again, I don't want to knock the D&D lane, but they're in it and they won't try something else. Right. And I understand that because most people don't have a lot of time. There's a rules change. I mean, once I get comfortable in something and I enjoy it, well, what is the incentive for, you know, maybe it's a certain style of character that I like. But one shots are a great way to dip your toe in the water, to basically go, especially, I'll tell you one of the things that I enjoy the most about one shots. When someone comes to me and tells me I want to run a campaign, I go back to my comfort zone with characters. Okay, I want to be a fighter. I'm going to be a, you know, I'm going back to the same well a lot because I'm going, well, I've got to play 10, 20 sessions of this. I'm, you know, I want to make sure I enjoy it. I find with one shots, I'm so exploratory. When it comes to characters, I'm just so much more willing to explore different types of characters. And that often leads to, wow, why didn't I do this before? I really enjoy this type of character. I really enjoy the setting. So now all of a sudden my well becomes that much deeper, right? In terms of the stuff that I enjoy and the stuff that I play.
Yeah. Well, to give you an example, I ran a game. We're actually, it's going to be a little more than one shot. We're going to do a follow-on adventure, but it was a 70s road trip game where the players ran into trouble. But effectively it's a buddy cop game, but they were playing football players and, you know, on the road trip, and then they get into this trouble. But, you know, there's not a game system out there to play football players in that, but with one shots, you can do that kind of thing. Right. And it's great.
Absolutely. Right. And it's funny, one of the best compliments that I got from a player, and I remember it was the end of the adventure. And they looked at me and they said, I can't believe I'll never play this character again. Uh-huh. And I was like, there's a bittersweetness to it. Right. And I was like, well, maybe there'll be a sequel, but yeah, it's like with a one shot, you have to be all in because it's finite, right? It's not going to continue. Right. So, and that to me is just kind of that makes them a little bit special. Campaigns are still special, but that makes them a little bit special.
And that's a reason, you know, we have a little bit of time left here. And we're not talking bad about other games or anything, but certain rule sets lend themselves to certain things. And if you take a rule set like Delta Green, or you take a rule set like Dungeon Crawl Classics and put it in a one shot, you end up tweaking the system. People end up tweaking the system where with Dungeon Crawl Classics, I'm going to burn all my abilities down to zero because I'm never going to play this character again. And with Delta Green, there's a system where you can offset your mental anguish to your contact. Tax and family members and things obviously in Delta Green, there's no negative to doing that if you're only playing a one shot, where if you're playing a system designed for one shots, like your system, those pitfalls or, you know, those loopholes aren't in there.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a good point. It's funny because you'll note in my rules, I include rules for continuing for campaign, for advancement and stuff like that. I haven't done as much. I haven't done as much playtesting on the campaign side. So I don't know how good the system would be after 20 sessions. I'm guessing, people's stats would probably be pretty high. It's probably not meant for that. But it's a great point that you're picking the system. That you should really pick the system based on the style of game. It's funny, even on the mood, that's another suggestion that I would put out to players. So there's a system that, so there's some systems which are very kind of action oriented and fast paced, and others where you want, like Call of Cthulhu is a great example, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you want a combat heavy game, that's probably not the choice, right? Mm-hmm. And so I find that systems can definitely influence how players play their characters. So selecting it, is something you should do carefully.
Yeah, I guess one thing I should have mentioned earlier, but I do want to capture in here. If people get your system and like it and want to write adventures for it, you do have a way for them to do that.
Yeah, so I didn't really think about this before the whole Wizards of the Coast opened, since that kind of fiasco. But why not? Like, why would I say no? So the only thing that I ask is that you just let me know. And there might be some guidelines that I haven't really put a whole lot of thought into it. So there's not going to be here's my 10-page legal document you need. I mean, there's nothing like that. It's just... more or less, I'd provide some guidance, but other than that, it's free for people to use.
Which is great. I mean, that's the So, well, I really appreciate your coming on. Is there anything you would like to plug? Anything that my listeners should like?
Listen, I tend to publish things in. I tend to go publish a lot, and then I go quiet for a while, and publish a lot just based on the time that I have. So I am going to be coming out with the Pulp Action 1935 So I love that time period. I think the publication is in a pretty good shape. So it's the rules version, but I am going to write an adventure. I have probably, I think I probably have a dozen adventures that are in the 80% complete range. So I guess there's a lot on DriveThruRPG right now, but there'll be a lot. You know, I'm hoping that in the next month or so, I'm just going to be finally getting some of these things completed and firing them out there. The only other thing that I would say is that I'm absolutely open to requests for, well, I need to like it. I mean, you know, so I need to, you know, it needs to be something that I'm interested in writing. But if there's a particular setting that you would, hey, you should do rules for pirates or whatever, right? Or a particular adventure in a setting that, or maybe even a sequel, I'm open to requests. Yeah. Other than that, thanks for enjoying the game. Thanks for this opportunity. And hopefully we'll be chatting again in the future. Maybe we'll even cross paths at a con.
Yeah, I hope so. I definitely hope to cross paths at the con at some point. And I hope folks go check your stuff out. I will have all your contact information in the show notes for everybody. And I just want to thank you again for your generous time.
Yeah, that's great. Pleasure to meet you, Jason.
Okay. Okay, folks, take care of yourselves. Be excellent to each other.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if the fiddle's even dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.